Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Join me, Chanel Danton, on the search for truth and guidance through conversations and content around the cosmic moments that can bring about exponential growth. You are invited to discover tools and techniques to manage challenges, master transitions, manifest abundance, and live your best life. The time for cosmic moments is now. Welcome.
Today I'm with Alexandra Zachary. She is qualified in music, naturopathy, osteopathy, transpersonal psychology, the Groff method, and is now an ayahuasquero in Peru. She's from Australia, and she's spent the last 3.5 years with a mestizo and has trained under 2 Shipibo women and is now holding ceremonies in the heart of Peru. You've been here for almost 2 years. And I have been lucky enough to actually sit with you. So thank you so much for that opportunity, but also for sharing your wisdom and your experience with us and the wider world on this podcast.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's absolutely a pleasure to be able to serve such amazing people from all over the world. I've actually been in Peru on and off for 5 years and decided to move here to really embrace the path 2 years ago, and since then it just keeps expanding. It's quite wonderful.
I'm really curious to know how you actually came about this path. I mean, it's quite different to living in Australia and psychology out there.
In Australia, you know, there's a lot of ancient wisdom there too, but so much has been lost. Do you want me to start with my interest in shamanism when I read Carlos Castaneda's books age 14, or a more recent
So it goes back to then. Was there particular traumas in your life that maybe led you to come to the heart of Peru, or was it just that curiosity?
I've always felt a really strong connection to Peru. Always. I had recurrent dreams as a 6-year-old. And one day my mother's sitting at the table with a book of South American mythology, and I pointed to Machu Picchu. I said, "That was the place where I was in my dreams, Mum." And she went, "Oh," and she was a firm believer of past lives, and she said, "Well, you better go there one day." And so even as a really small child, I thought I'd end up here sometime, somehow. Wow. but this particular part of my life has started with my first journeys overseas in 2012, and I went to Galapagos in Ecuador, and in Ecuador I met a curandero in the cloud forest, and he said, "Oh yes, you better go do some training and your teacher will be in the mountains, go to Peru." And so I went back to Australia and I kind of had that in the back of my mind, and 2 years later I turned up here, and on the third day of being in the Sacred Valley, my teacher walks in and he says, "Oh yeah, I've been watching you in the spirit world, and let's start the work." And I changed my flights and I was here for 2.5 months instead of 2.5 weeks, and I began my training then.
Wow. And for our listeners, could you just explain what a curandero is?
So the traditional healers in South America have lots of different names. Some people like to call themselves medicos or medicas, male or female, or curandero, curandera, so someone who cures. If you work with a particular plant as your main focus, I work with ayahuasca as my main plant spirit, and so I'm an ayahuasquera. If you work with San Pedro, then you're a huachumera. Or I share my house with a tabaquera, whose primary medicine is mapacho, the sacred tobacco of South America and North America.
And on that lineage of, you know, sharing the ayahuasca, so you're an ayahuascaera now, does that take away from the Peruvian culture? I mean, you're a white woman, you're Australian. Is that in any way sacrilegious or
I often get asked about my perception of cultural appropriation, and it is something I'm aware of course. But as an Australian, where unless you're an Aboriginal person, everything is culturally appropriated, you know. I'm a mongrel from half a dozen different cultures and ended up with my family in Australia, and I think sharing culture, I have a firm belief in the global village that technology and transport has now made a reality. And the sharing of wisdom, the sharing of knowledge is more important to the Indigenous people that I've spent time with and trained with. And not one of my teachers has ever questioned whether I'm native or not, whether they don't care where I'm from, they don't care if I'm male or female, they don't care, you know, all they care about is my commitment to the work and my connection with the plants and you know, my dedication.
And how many of the Peruvian locals actually come to sit in ceremony with you? Is that something that happens often? Is that something that's really going back into the local community?
It's quite interesting. I mean, there is such cultural trauma here from, you know, the Spanish invasion and then the Christian missionary work that happened here. There's so much removal, particularly for people living in urban environments, so much removal from the traditional lifestyles, whether it's the Andean sacred traditions or the Amazonian sacred traditions. But interestingly, since kind of the 60s, 70s, when Westerners have come in, anthropologists and ethnobotanists and then just kind of interesting investigative people like Terence McKenna and his brother Dennis, and you know, the works of William S. Burroughs with the Yeage letters, and the Westerners have actually brought the traditions back to the Peruvian people in a big way. And I do get you know, several Peruvians a month coming to sit with me because they're looking for something that's outside of the urban westernized medical situation, and they're looking to come back to their traditional medicines. So yeah, I do get some Peruvians, and it's a real privilege, and I feel so honored, you know, that they would trust me as a Westerner.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
But it's extraordinary, like this cross-cultural exchange.
Yeah, what I really appreciated about when you held ceremony for us was that your psychology background enabled you to really allow that integration of what was seen or what was experienced. So I understand that the ayahuasca medicine is for emotional turmoil and to bring that up or to bring that into balance or to let go. What other troubles would ayahuasca be used for as a medicine?
Ayahuasca's using ayahuasca is part of an Indigenous medical system. I mean, it addresses physical ailments, it addresses ailments on many, many levels. I mean, the shamanic perspective, all things are manifestations of the spiritual realm. There's no separation, and we sit in the middle of three worlds, and those worlds encompass the animal kingdom, the animal, mineral, vegetable kingdoms, but also the spiritual realms, the angelic realms, you know, mythical beings. So for an Indigenous shamanic practitioner, and I embrace that perspective, if a patient comes to me with prostate cancer, for instance, then I look at not just what's happening on a physical level, but I look at it on an energetic level. And, you know, I speak to him about psychological issues. I speak to him about emotional issues. I look at his whole history. Mm-hmm. But so when you're addressing that, you can't separate any part of ourselves. It's the most holistic approach that you can possibly get.
And I read a bit about people with alcoholism coming to do ayahuasca as a cure. How does that work, and is it really something that is a cure to alcoholism?
It's certainly in my experience in the last 5 years, it's really shown me that it's very, very helpful for addictions, mm-hmm. particularly because my belief is that addiction is symptomatic. Mm-hmm. It's not causative. So if you are suffering addiction, it's not even the substance that's causing the addiction. I mean, you know, the Native American peoples have used tobacco as a sacred plant for years and nobody had a smoking addiction.
Mm. But they don't inhale it when they use it, do they?
Yeah, oh, yes. They do? Okay. Sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there've been fermented alcoholic beverages in most cultures, but not alcoholism, for instance, until the displacement and genocide in indigenous cultures.
Mm.
And now the remnants of those cultures have a huge alcohol problem, not because of the actual substance, but because of the collective trauma. And I'm a real fan of a Canadian physician called Gabor Mate, and people can check him out on YouTube. He's my total hero, and he works very predominantly with addictions and traumas. And I'm with him in my belief that many, many, many problems, in fact, the majority of problems, all boil down to particularly early childhood traumas, birth traumas, and my training in the Groff perspective also is focused on early childhood traumas. And one thing that ayahuasca particularly can do for that is it can allow you to go into a memory of that trauma and reprogram yourself around that. You can understand it, you can express the emotions that might have been suppressed, you can release those patterns.
So when you were with the Mestizo and the Shipibos, was it your psychology background that allowed you to go so much deeper? So for someone that's wanting to go and train with these people, is it the language barrier create a problem? Or, you know, I mean, how did they explain to you what was happening, what was going on?
Well, they didn't much.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
I've always had the gift of vision, in that I can see energetic forms and I can see people's auras and things. And, you know, my scientific mind sat that aside for a lot of years, but it's, you know, I have a particular sight,
mm-hmm.
and it is a gift. And you know, sometimes you think you're completely insane and, oh right, I've gone crazy now, never mind. but actually it is a real gift. And so my first teacher, I just went to the jungle with him, and he just said, no, you just drink every night, and you sit in ceremony every night for 2 months. And various clients would come and go. We had groups of war veterans from Canada and the States. We had a huge variety of people looking to heal, mostly emotionally based issues. And I just observed what was happening in ceremony on the medicine.
Mm.
And I could see what energetic work my teacher was actually doing. And then I was developing relationships with the other teacher plants, and seeing what benefits those plants have energetically as well as on a physical level. And I just gradually started singing in ceremony with him and his mother and father, who are also shamans, until, you know, that was the learning. It really wasn't, you know, I came here with an academic background going, okay, so where's the textbook? And let's tick off all the things I have to learn on a list. And he's just like, forget book learning.
Mm.
This is direct experiential learning. And the only way to do it is to do it.
Mm.
And so I started doing it.
How did you know you were ready to do it, to hold space for other people? What was that feeling, that
To start my own ceremonies?
Yeah.
Well, it was with some trepidation.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, where's my certificate? Where's my diploma? I need a banana leaf saying, yes, you are a qualified shaman now. both of my female teachers, who are Shipibo trained, and they both said to me, because I was like, oh, people keep asking me, can you serve medicine to me? And I'm like, oh, I don't know.
Mm.
And they both said, look, if people, that's when you know you're ready, when people are coming for healing and the plant's bringing them and you're just the servant of the plant spirit, and go for it. And so very nervously, I served my first ceremony and found it that I could in fact hold that space, and I could in fact do the work, and it was like this amazing revelation. And then, you know, it took a few months of building confidence, and now it's clearly what I'm doing, and people keep coming to me, so I must be doing something right.
Yeah, because you've been holding ceremony for over a year, almost 2 years now. There's so many fear stories that are out there about, you know, people going and trying ayahuasca and then dying. Was that ever a fear that came up? Someone sitting in your ceremony and keeling over? Like, you know, why does that happen? Why are those stories out there? Are they real?
There are actually no officially reported deaths directly due to ayahuasca.
Mm.
Ayahuasca itself is a safe substance. However, it does have many interactions with pharmaceuticals, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
It does alter your blood pressure. So if you have a heart issue undiagnosed, that can be a problem. I screen, you know, I speak with the potential clients and screen for medications, screen for recreational drugs, because, you know, clearly if you've been partying on alcohol and cocaine for a week, it's really not a good idea to go and then think you're okay to just drink ayahuasca. But also I screen for psychiatric issues. There are a few situations that really would require a very, very safe container, long-term healing work to be of benefit. So, for instance, if someone with schizoaffective disorder or schizophrenia of one sort or another came and asked to work with me, then I probably wouldn't put them within a group context. They would need to come work individually in a space that could be really safe for them.
Mm-hmm.
And probably they would need to work for 3 months, maybe. I do believe that it would be of benefit, but I think for the safety of them and for the safety of other people, it's not great to have them in a group setting.
What would that preparation be like? So for someone that had schizophrenia, or what about heroin addictions, or really, you know, those that were the preparation for that?
So if I was to work, I haven't worked with anyone who was dealing with a heroin addiction thus far.
Mm-hmm.
If they really were 100% committed to change, then of course I would offer assistance, but they would have to have kicked it before they come.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, dealing with withdrawal symptoms, you know, you have to have a really strong infrastructure for people to experience that stuff.
Mm.
And I'm not in a physical environment, I'm not in the situation. Maybe if I one day have my own centre with a sort of a part of the centre is for long-term stays, then possibly. But I still think, no, you'd have to be clean of the substance before you came to work.
Sorry, so I asked two questions in one there. Mm. So for preparation, what would a preparation to participate in medicine look like?
So when I offer single ceremonies, mm-hmm. then that level of experience is something different than if you really come to work for a month and do multiple ceremonies. Mm-hmm. There's this concept called the dieta, mm-hmm. where you have very restricted foods and you stay in solitude as much as possible. It's almost like a meditation retreat, and mm-hmm. you work with the plants really deeply, and you do ayahuasca ceremonies sort of once a week through 3 or 4 weeks, or just even at the beginning and the end, and you do a shorter, mm-hmm. shorter diet. There's this concept of the ayahuasca diet, and every single practitioner you talk to has a different idea of what people should be eating and what people shouldn't be eating. I think the ayahuasca diet, in inverted commas, that people will come across on the internet and come across if they, you know, chat with other people. This was kind of an invention, as far as I'm aware, for Westerners to come, because in the West we're so toxic that really people need to detox for a few weeks before they come clean enough to really benefit from these Amazonian medicines. Otherwise the ayahuasca itself will just purge all the toxins out, and it's just working on that level rather than going deeper into more psychological or spiritual realms. Yeah.
Right. So it's really just getting rid of those processed toxins and salts and that kind of thing. It's
And even, you know, the cleanest yoga head vegan coming from California, I mean, is, you know, there's just so much toxicity in the air and the water and the plastics we use in, you know, that even so, it is a really good idea, if you're serious about coming for the medicine work, to stick to a really clean diet. And there are certain things that energetically, like salt, mm-hmm. or chili, or things that are very strong energetically, that are best avoided. And then sexual abstinence is a really good idea as well, because you want to contain all your energies. If you have a sexual release, you're releasing a lot of energy, and so it's recommended no sexual release of any sort for a couple of weeks before you come and work.
That's interesting. And the contraindications, just a recap of who shouldn't do ayahuasca.
If you are on certain heart medications, if you are on SSRIs, antidepressants, there are very clear contraindications for certain medications. There's a database that I look up when people do have medication. That's something that you have to be very careful with, and you're better off looking it up yourself and making a decision. But things like, if you're on something that's naturally occurring in the body, like thyroxine or estrogen, progesterone, so something that is endogenous to the body, but you need to replace, or you need to take as a supplement, then that's usually fine.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And I read about this tobacco drink, the mapacho.
Yeah.
Well, how does that interact with ayahuasca? Why is that used in conjunction?
Yeah. My flatmate, who's a tabaquera, and she and I are working with people together, and we're running retreats now with tobacco, and then one tobacco ceremony, two ayahuasca ceremonies. What tobacco does is it's really very cleansing. It really clears out the physical body, clears out the energetic body, and then it really grounds you. So it's often a really good preparation to go into ayahuasca ceremonies because you're already clean,
mm-hmm.
and your feet are on the ground, and so you're not likely to whoosh off into outer space. You can actually stay with yourself and do the work in the ceremonies.
And so that's actually drinking it. It's not smoking it?
No, or? You don't. There's no requirement to smoke.
Yeah.
You drink it, a bowl of it. Sometimes you snort the liquid of it up your nose, and that's not my personal favourite, but it certainly works wonders.
And then does it make you purge?
It makes you purge, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the conjunction together, like would that be used in the same night, or is it?
No, you do them
separately.
Yeah, you do them in sequence. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about this upcoming retreat that you're going to host.
It's combining mapacho and ayahuasca with lots of sound healing work, and it's called Finding Your Voice. So for women with trauma, women with who want to get in touch with their creativity, who want to be able to express themselves better. So we have 5 sessions of vocal work and yoga nada, which is voice yoga, and sound baths and drum circles, and combining those things with the 3 plant medicine ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have an Andino offering to the spirits of the mountains and the land here, and a sweat lodge, a traditional Andean temazcal ceremony.
Awesome.
So it's going to be pretty exciting.
It sounds beautiful. We'll put the details of that in the show notes.
Oh, thank you.
Ayahuasca in Peru is becoming quite a tourist trap, or
absolutely.
What's your thoughts on that, and how do you make sure that you're not put into that cup of, you know, just taking advantage of tourists, I guess, or like?
Well, I never agree to have someone come sit in ceremony with me unless I've really talked to them first.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't just stick up a poster and say come one, come all, because that's not what I'm about. So when I do turn people away if it's clear that they're just here as trooper tourists. I'm not interested. You know, I'm interested in actually doing deep work with people. And I think it's actually quite, there's a lot of dangers. You know, I know people who have no training, who come here for a 10-day retreat and then go open a center in Florida and serve medicine illegally to anyone without a shaman, with recorded music, with, you know, just, and it makes me squirm. First of all, it's totally disrespecting the traditions, and second of all, it's actually physically dangerous to people, let alone emotionally dangerous. I prefer to work with a maximum of 6 people at a time. Our retreat, we have a maximum of 10 people, but there's 2 of us working together. And for instance, when I served your group was already formed, and I had 2 facilitators working with me. So, you know, that was possible.
Yeah.
But,
and it was a month-long yoga retreat.
Exactly.
Before that.
Yeah, so you guys were super prepared. And really in a very, very good space, an ideal group for me. I loved it. It was wonderful.
It was really beautiful. Our retreat together was amazing, or our ceremony together was amazing. But I have read a lot of stories where they've exploited tourists, and I just want to understand more about how the ceremonial, the ayahuasca, the medicine, is actually obtained, and how it's possible for people to actually obtain that medicine without having that kind of knowledge and background. Like, do they just go to Shipibo and buy a bottle? Like, how freely obtainable is this stuff?
Well, when I can't cook my own, I get some from my teacher's cook in Pucallpa in the jungle, because I absolutely trust the quality and sustainability, actually, of these plants, because for me that's a big issue as well, that, you know, that now there's so much tourism surrounding the medicine that it's being chronically over-harvested.
Mm.
And I actually have several friends with planting projects and sustainability projects, which I'm supporting. But yeah, it's people can go get it. I mean, it's around. There's a lot of poverty here. There's a lot of poverty. And people trying to feed their families, so they go, we'll cut vine and sell it to whoever will pay money for it, of course. There's also a lot of charlatanism. You know, I've sat in a cafe in Iquitos and had people come up to me and offer me bottles of this brown sludgy stuff that may or may not have been ayahuasca, you know, just guys off the street, because there's a market. There's huge cultural interaction issues, you know, both Westerners and Peruvians, you know, throw on a feathered headdress and say, yeah, I'm a shaman, here, drink this stuff and give me $300. And it does happen. And then there's a lot of sexual exploitation with charlatans, but also actually with legit trained practitioners as well, because there is a cultural difference between attitudes towards sexuality and attitudes towards women. And, you know, it's very, very complex. Very complex. One thing that I feel is really important is to have ethical standards. And I know there are Indigenous people attempting to set standards, create associations, you know, have some kind of standardization of practice and medicine and the actual quality of the medicine itself. But it's very difficult. Very difficult. And so for me, I get a lot of clients looking for a woman for a start, because they don't feel they feel much safer and someone who speaks English fluently, of course, because you can communicate properly, and someone who is older and clearly, you know, not out for exploitation.
Yeah, because you were explaining that some of the medicine can actually bring up sexual energy, right?
Yeah.
And so when you're with the Shipibo... there's been times when there's exploitation of that sexual energy. Is that correct?
Well, there's a lot of stories, and I've witnessed some situations that, a pretty young Western girl, possibly with sexual trauma, you know, is exploited under the influence of the medicine by the practitioner, because it's easy, you know. And you know, that woman will go home with more trauma.
That's true.
And it does happen, and I urge anyone who is considering coming to Peru to really research, to really talk to the people at the retreat center and ask them, you know, what are their ethical standards, and really, really research that. Be careful.
So when you're in the space of being under the influence of the medicine, and you're seeing energetic powers and all the rest, how do you protect yourself from not being attacked by any supernatural evil energy, or, you know, if you're around someone that maybe holds bad energy? Or,
well, this is very much the Indigenous perspective, that there is very black and white positive negative influences. For me personally, as I've been a practicing Buddhist for 20 something years, I see that we are connected in a unified state to God, to Buddha nature, to Christ consciousness, whatever you choose to name it. So for me personally, I have a meta level understanding of these things. And of course, then we have to embody them in the three dimensions, in the state of duality, of separation from God, So for me, there are certainly protective measures to not entangle with energies per se, but I don't really view them as wholly evil or wholly good. So, but that's my unique viewpoint. It's certainly not a traditional viewpoint.
What about someone that's interested in participating but scared off maybe a negative entity from someone else, if it's a group setting, coming into their body? Or, I don't know, that sounds a bit woo-woo, but...
Yeah. No, well, there's plenty of woo-woo out there. I mean, this is why in my ceremonies I insist on silence, like no speaking for several hours, no touching. You know, it's really about staying within your own space and having your own experience. And if someone needs to speak or express loudly, then I'll take them outside of the room so that they can do that, but not interfere with other people's process. I use some traditional methods. I use certain stones. I use certain very protective plants. And I also do my own meditations and psychic protections. And when I set the space, I use mapacho, which is highly protective as well, and Palo Santo, another sacred plant. And I create mentally a psychic space protecting the entire room. But I haven't honestly come across that as a problem. It's like people come in with things attached to them, and I could describe that as psychological process. I could describe that as, you know, trauma. I could describe that as past life issues, if that's your paradigm. I could describe it as you know, a spirit or, you know, an entity of some sort. But ultimately, when you're working with the energies purely as energies, all those stories are irrelevant. So when I have my individual client in front of me, I see what language they prefer to speak in. And someone, say, from a fundamentalist Christian language, for instance, would talk about their demons. And so I talk to them on that level, but someone from a kind of Western science mind, I'll talk to them about more psychological standpoint. So really, I don't have my own personal beliefs about these things. I just see energies and try and move them.
And it's interesting. So you actually see these energies and you see spirit. And when we sat, you said that you saw some of my ancestors. And when you were with the veterans, what kind of stuff did you see there? Like that?
I was very much looking on an energetic level. Obviously they spoke about some of their horrific experiences in Afghanistan, in Bosnia, in, you know, all in Iraq. My empathetic self, my heart just poured out to these guys hearing these stories. But in ceremony itself, the stories really become irrelevant to me. And I see the energetic body of the person with discolorations, or with like a smoky kind of cloud over a certain area, or with spikes coming out. Sometimes the spikes can look like spears or darts. Sometimes they can look like sort of jagged glass, or you know. And so in practical energetic work, you just address the energies directly, and you can do that via various means, mostly through the ikaros, which are the songs that come to you during ceremony.
Yeah, and you have a beautiful voice. Maybe we could get a little recording of the songs that you sing. But yeah, when you're in ceremony, do they just come to you and come out, or was it?
So the first few that I used to open the ceremony, I learned from my mestizo teacher, and thank you. I'm grateful for everything I learned with him. And then the others that come either come spontaneously from the medicine itself that night, or they've come through my own dieta, working with different plants. And that's an extraordinary process. You go on this very restricted diet in solitude, and you drink a tea made of whichever master plant you're working with. And you know, you drink the first night, and the second morning you just have a song in your head, and it just goes round and round, and it won't leave you alone. And that's happened half a dozen times now. I've done 14 diets so far, and yeah, I've been blessed with 6 plant songs.
Wow.
And then you try it out in ceremony, and you sing it, and you see what it does.
Yeah.
And you go, wow, and it brings the benefits of that plant to the people in the room just through the song. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it was really extraordinary when you sang, the energy, you could feel the changes in the room, you know, that was really extraordinary. Going back to the sustainability of the plant, could you actually explain what goes into an ayahuasca drink?
Okay, so the vine Baniopsteris capi is ayahuasca, or yage, or, you know, it's called many different names, but ayahuasca is the, you know, the most popular name. And ayahuasca means vine of death or vine of the dead. And I think that's essentially because it can put you through what's known as ego death in popular parlance, where you lose your sense of self into a unified state, and that can feel like dying. Which is why there's a lot of fear often for people to let go of their egoic self and to melt into Godhead, melt into the universe. But trust me, it's the most wonderful, extraordinary, best thing you could ever do for yourself if you manage it.
Could it also be called the plant of death because you can see those that have passed on, those people that have died?
Traditionally, the Shipibo particularly that I've talked to, they really don't like talking to ancestors or people who have passed. It's just not part of their... They have superstitions around that.
Interesting.
For me, ancestor work is very important. I think that's because I've also investigated my own heritage in, with Siberian shamanism, and a lot of that is rooted in working with ancestors. So for me personally, that's important.
Right.
But it's not necessarily an Amazonian tradition. Mm-hmm. So the vine, and you beat it to a pulp, and boil it up with the leaves. The leaves that I use are chacruna, which is probably the most common source of DMT. So the vine provides the MAOI inhibitor, which stops an enzyme in the stomach preventing DMT to go into the bloodstream. So this is the vine actually has this inhibitor, and then you need a source of DMT. So chacruna is the most commonly used or the most traditionally used. I also use another plant which is a high source of DMT called Huambisa, but not as frequently. And there are DMTs contained in most plants. It's contained in our brains. It's ubiquitous in nature. So there's many sources. In Australia, you can use black wattle. It's a high source of DMT.
And DMT is released when you're born and released when you die, right? In the human body.
There are floods. There are certain times in life where your brain floods yourself with DMT.
So taking it in this plant form, is that unhealthy in a way? Or
I can't see any adverse effects.
Yeah. And it couldn't bring on a state of psychosis ongoing for people? Like,
well, I think if it's mishandled.
Yeah.
I think if the set and setting, if it's not taken seriously, absolutely. The same with any psychedelic substance. I mean, you mess with your brain chemistry and things are going to change there. If you're in a safe container and if you have thorough preparation and thorough follow-up and integration afterwards, then as far as I can see, it's absolutely safe. I mean, there is currently various researches going on in the West about these things,
yeah,
which is fantastic.
Yeah, they're bringing it back, right, to cure depression and all the rest using psychedelic treatment.
Yeah, but of course, you know, anything can be dangerous if mishandled.
Right. And the taxing of drinking the ayahuasca, that I understand that it's taxing on your kidneys and your liver. Is that correct? Or?
Well, I've drunk over 500 times now, probably, in 5 years. You know, I like to do a nice kidney flush and liver cleanse, sure. And I need, you know, I'm taking 2 weeks off to do my own work, personal work, the next 2 weeks. And I'm looking forward to having a break. But if you come for three or four ceremonies, then there's absolutely no harm that I can see.
Yeah. A standard for the show, and you've actually shared so many already, which we'll put in the show notes, but if we could just recap on two or three books that you would recommend for our listeners.
Gabor Mate's In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, I would highly recommend. Stanislav Grof, if you're interested in his approach to psychology, then Spiritual Emergence C is probably my favourite of his books. If you're interested in DMT and a more scientific approach, then The Spirit Molecule is one of the best explorations of that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so, so very much to share the space with you and then hear all the stories and messages that you've shared with me. So thank you.
Thank you. Oh, it's just, it's such a beautiful opportunity to connect and share. And yeah, so please, anyone listening, please just be really careful of who you choose to drink medicine with, and just really talk with them deeply before you say yes. And hopefully they will talk deeply with you before they say yes as well.
And with your permission, I'll put links both in the notes and also on the Cosmic Moments website. And if people have questions, they can come back to you and ask you.
Thank
and
you.
Maybe find you on their journey.
Lovely.
If you found today's episode inspirational and informative, please consider joining me on Patreon. I'll put the link in the show notes, as this helps me fund these passion projects, help more people on their transformative journeys, and give information on an ongoing basis. Please hit subscribe if you like this so that you're notified every time we post a new episode. And join us on Facebook at Cosmic Moments for information about upcoming retreats, or you can head over to cosmicmoments.com. Have a cosmic day, and I look forward to connecting with you more.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.